Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday, Tuesday, Casual Tuesday, Wednesday, Casual Hump Day, Thursday, Casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 8th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. Folks, we have a great program for you today. As you know, I am still on vacation. What am I doing on vacation?
He's hanging out with me. He's doing a lot of stuff. Just to remind you, my name is Milo Ray Cedar, and I'm telling him that I really like him, but sometimes he yells at me.
What? I don't yell at you.
Sometimes he gets mad at me, but he still works.
Okay, hold on for one second. Today on the program, my interview with Senator Al Franken from Netroots Nation a couple of weeks ago, and also my interview with... Hold on a minute. Hold on, kid. Just hold on. Don't touch that. And with Marcos Melitzes from Netroots Nation. And folks, this is a great time. Now that I've got you all buttered up to say, why not become a member of the Majority Report? Do you think you're going to need braces?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Huh. And what else do you expect? I mean, are you going to have a debutante party when you turn 16?
Maybe.
Yeah, yeah. And what else? You're going to get married to a boyfriend, and I guess I'll have to pay for that, too. So, folks, if I'm going to keep this young lady in the, with all the expenses that you're going to become for, please become a member. Support the show. It's the only way I can continue. It's the only way I can continue the show. If you become a member, you can join at majority.fm. And, of course, you can always support the show by buying your junk through Amazon. But what I really need is members. And the only way I can continue to do this show is if I get more members. I know there are thousands upon thousands out there who must enjoy the show every day. Otherwise, why do you keep downloading it? For gosh sakes. What? I said gosh. I said gosh. That's not a bad word.
Yeah, but
sakes is okay.
No, it's not okay. Okay.
All right. See what I'm dealing with here, folks? Please. All right. Now my interview with Al Franken. I will see you on Monday. I will be back live. So, Senator Franken, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And this is actually your second Netroots Nation visit, yes? You were. Yeah.
Oh, it's Netroots?
You weren't aware of what it was?
No, I thought it was Netroots. I've been pronouncing it wrong this whole time. I thought it was Netroots, no?
No one wanted to correct you.
I understand why. I'm a senator.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. People, wear the pin now.
Yeah,
and so people
I do.
But yeah, it's your second time here, and I want to talk. It's a real pleasure for me, obviously, to talk to you on the radio as a senator. I've spoken to you on the radio as a non-senator.
Well, as peers.
Yes, and we have both moved in sort of completely opposite directions. I wouldn't. I mean, it's not a big deal.
You've moved. I think you moved in a
lateral.
Lateral. I wouldn't say I've moved. I wouldn't say mine isn't lateral as well. It's just lateral to a whole different field.
Well, you know, actually, let's talk about it because I want to talk about what you spoke about in your speech today. Because
sure.
I think this is sort of the pressing issue facing our country right now. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the because I think our listeners would be very curious to get a sense of what it feels like to move from the perspective that you had as someone who I perceive and always felt that you were one of the most informed people in politics, about politics, not in politics.
Sure.
And now you're in politics. You've gone from sort of outside looking in to inside looking out. To explain to me, like, what that feels like.
It's different, I got to tell you. I mean, it's a different job. And in many ways, it's harder. I think one thing about being a radio host is that and the work you do on TV, too, and work I was doing on TV, is that you kind of get to pick what you talk about all the time. I mean, within a certain range of issues. That's not quite the same as a senator. Senator, you're dealing with everything all at the same time. I mean, you have committee assignments, and you do have little areas you can stake out. I mean, and that you can pick and be the expert on or be the guy who does that or the person who works on that. But you also are not, you really are, have responsibilities as one of only 100 to be dealing with sort of everything. And it's also, you know, I came from comedy and I used a lot of humor in my radio show. And it's, I just can't do that as much in humor is useful in the Senate in terms of being funny around colleagues,
right?
But it's not like I can't go on the floor and be funny. I mean, I just can't, you know.
Right.
Hearing something spontaneous comes up, it's fine. It's and also there are a number of arrows in my comedy quiver. And that I cannot use.
Right. You got to be careful as to which one you pull out.
I can use I can't use the inappropriate arrow, which is a very
And I noticed
arrow.
You actually took some time in trying to figure out how to describe that inappropriate
arrow. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, it's an arrow that's very commonly used in comedy. It just is. I mean, and also especially with comedy writers in rooms with other comedy writers. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I understand.
And so that's off. But even you can't even use just plain old scorn and ridicule.
Right.
That's not good. You can use
self-deprecating. Imagine, you know, you were talking yesterday a little bit about that you have on many occasions or reached across the aisle to work with some Republicans on stuff that's, you know, not terribly controversial,
no.
At least so that you can find...
Dogs for vets with emotional and mental wounds.
And I would imagine that building those relationships... I mean, I think people would be surprised, and tell me if I'm wrong, just how much personal relationships matter
They actually do. And it opens you up to... You know, my wife, Franny, has... very good relationships with a lot of spouses of the Republican spouses. And so we've had, you know, we'll have like NZ from Wyoming and Johans over for dinner. And then I'll be able, you know, and then it'll change the kind of conversation I can have with Mike Enzi, who's the ranking member of the Help Committee on No Child Left Behind reauthorization. It just makes a difference. It just helps.
And
that's, you know, that has a sort of different, it's not the same terrible kind of, you know, problems that we're having on budget stuff and that kind of thing. It's a different, it has more substantive stuff that isn't quite so partisan, although there are certain divides now among Republican and Democrats on what the role of the federal government is versus the states in No Child Left Behind.
Is the Senate more dysfunctional now than it was even last year? I mean, at the beginning of this...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, last year it was dysfunctional, but we had 59. And when we had 59, it was easier to get things done than when you have 53. And now you just can't get anything. It's really hard. We have not had a jobs bill. We and with the House the way it is, we, for example, we passed an FAA bill, and we did a pretty bipartisan basis, but we can't get the conferees from the House to be assigned.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
They won't even show up to reconcile.
Well, they haven't chosen their conferees, you know. So that's a jobs bill, by the way, the FAA bill. And so in 2010, I seem to recall they were talking about jobs a lot. I haven't seen a jobs bill come out of the House. And I've seen them, I've seen in the Senate them pretty much bottling up every jobs bill that we have.
Do you think that there's some regret on behalf of Democrats who had, there was a window where people were talking about reforming the rules of the Senate, you know, early on?
Yeah,
in this,
well, there, it was,
do you think there's some regret that the opportunity wasn't taken?
You know, you have to do it with 50 or 51. We weren't even sure where Biden would be on that, because remember, he'd been in the institution for a long time, and there was a real divide between those who'd been in for a really long time and
who didn't want to change the filibuster rules at all or anything.
Well, yes, exactly. We wanted to change the filibuster rules. No one wanted to get rid of the filibuster, although Harkin actually wanted to get it down to where over a period of time it would get down to 51 that you needed, which is really, in a way, getting rid of the filibuster. But most of us felt like, no, keep it at 60, but you have to hold the floor of the Senate. You have
right.
to pay a price to do a filibuster. You have to actually filibuster. It has to look a little like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Right, right.
You know, you have to do it. It doesn't have to be one. If only one person is filibustering, then one person can hold it as long until they collapse like Jimmy Stewart did. But if...
and that would be a great YouTube, I would add.
I was thinking of doing one where I mean, this is like what I can't do. You know, I was thinking of doing one where I pretend I'm filibustering, but I collapse, like, in about 45 seconds. I just thought that'd be funny, but I don't do that.
So do you think there's any sense? That, I mean, do people regret that, though? I mean, do you think there are senators?
I think there are senators who
regret that they didn't take that opportunity?
No, because I think the ones that stopped us from doing it still believe that they did the right thing.
And
I don't know why exactly. And there are some people I respect, but they're really the old war horses.
Let's talk about...
I heard a lot of guys say, you know, wait till you're in the minority.
Right, in terms
yeah,
of what...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I hope that in the event that that does happen, which I hope it doesn't happen, but in the event that it does, that people exercise the...
Restraint on the other side?
An equal amount of restraint, or
yeah.
I should say lack of restraint.
Well, I mean, that on the Republicans don't immediately go, boom, okay, we got 51, let's change all the rules. That's what you're hoping they
don't
do, right?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping they don't change those rules, I guess, but I think it's also hoping that if they don't change those rules, that the Democrats will exercise the same
lack of restraint in stopping them. We aren't as disciplined as them, but we... there'll be enough of us to stop egregious stuff. Let's not even talk like this, though. We're going to win.
Right.
We're going to keep the majority.
I
forever and ever.
Well, let's talk about some of the points you brought up today in your speech, because you spoke. Well, you basically said that progressives. I'm going to quote you. In fact.
Okay.
Progressives are losing. We progressives are losing the argument. That you acknowledge that there are reasons for us to be frustrated with what Democrats are doing in Washington, what the president might be doing, but that we're losing the broader argument.
What I was basically saying is, like, you know, we all know there's global warming. how are we losing that argument? You know, we want to do cap and trade and. That's what we should be maybe arguing over. Now I had a thing the other day, and there are these forest fires out west, right? And they're much worse because of climate change.
Right.
And I asked the director of, the chief of the Forest Service about it, and he said, yeah, our scientists say that it's much worse because of climate change. Then I had a Republican colleague of mine say, you know, I have a degree in forestry. Forest management, which I'm sure Senator Franken doesn't have. And then he started he didn't ask a question. He just did a speech on
trees.
On how environmentalists have caused this because they don't
cull the forest.
Yeah, cut the forest, which there is an actual little point there that there is a thing called sustainable forests, and we do have to do some cleaning out of that stuff. But then, thank God we had a second round. And I said, well, I come at this with a great deal of humility. I don't have a degree in forest management. But let me ask you, Chief, the scientists in your Department of Forestry, do they have degrees?
Yes.
And what would those be in? And so I made my point. But the fact is that we're having that argument.
Well, yeah,
means we're losing the argument because it's just crazy.
But aren't we losing? Aren't we ultimately, at the end of the day, we're losing that argument?
And we're losing argument for that we're having this argument about collective bargaining.
Right.
That's a sign that we're losing the argument.
But aren't all of these arguments that we're losing a function of the biggest one that you mentioned in terms of the income disparity that we're having? I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, aren't we losing these arguments because there is so much more money to fund the argument on the other side? Whether they do it through the Heritage Foundation, whether they do it through Cato Institute, whether they do it through the AFP.
Yeah, but that was
AFP.
True in 2006 and in 2008.
And difference.
So we can win the argument. There are times we win the argument.
2006, 2008. I mean, what I'm asking is that when we have a situation where we have the administration now talking, and I think I heard Harry Reid yesterday talking about $2.5 trillion worth of cuts, $3 trillion worth of cuts. When we have a situation where taxes still on the rich, not at the lowest levels they've been in 50 or 60 years. Isn't that the fundamental argument that we're losing, and don't we need our leadership in Washington to be making that argument with us?
Yeah, and it needs to be coming out of the White House. Listen, that's your bully pulpit. That's your bully pulpit. When you have the White House, that's the one who leads the argument. And I think that the president sometimes is torn between using that pulpit in the right way and then also perceiving that independents want us to all get along and work together. And I think that temperamentally he has a large part of himself in that camp, which is he sees himself as someone who can get people to work together. And I think that to some degree, the White House steps on itself. And that's, I think, partly why we're not winning the argument sufficiently. But I said in the speech, I think that we've been handed the argument, and it is essentially what the Republicans did in the House, which was to get rid of Medicare as we know it. You know, I spoke at a Jefferson Jackson Day dinner in Michigan the day after that vote, and I remember saying in the speech and getting kind of a big laugh on this, I said, you know, right after the 2010 election, a lot of people wondered if Republicans would overinterpret their mandate. And I think they did. And, this is something we can went on, because Newt Gingrich said it right. This is radical, so radical that people, you know, and then he's been trying to back off of that for a long time, but he was right.
Right.
And this is basically saying that when this kicks in, when the Ryan plan kicks in, you're going to have to double, seniors will have to double the amount of out-of-pocket costs to about $12,500 per year for their medical costs. There was never any private health insurance market for people over 65,
right,
before Medicare was passed, and for a reason. I had a woman at the state fair a couple years ago when all that arguments, you know, the Tea Party people were screaming at people at forums at town meetings. She came up to me. She's about 75 years old, I'd say, and she said, "You know, when you're at my age, everything's pre-existing." And it's true. When you're 75 years old, you got a lot of things wrong with you. And guess what? Insurance companies don't like covering you.
Exactly.
So this is why Medicare was so important. And people know it. And they've been paying into it their whole life. And I'm being told, like, someone pointed to their watch. Which
either someone's selling you a watch or we've run out of time. But
I thought they wanted me to fix their watch. Huh.
Senator Fragan, I am...
See, that's why your staying in this business has kept you
sharp. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Knowing that someone pointed at a watch means time. Time's running out.
Yeah, right. Not please fix my time.
Find someone on your staff who can take my watch to a place. Sam, it's always great talking to you.
It's
great
talking to
you. You are doing marvelously. You look... great. You look great.
I look good.
Well, when you do radio... Let's face it.
You get a little fat.
No, it's not fat.
You get a little soft.
No, it's not soft. It's
sitting.
It's dirty.
Yeah. That's right.
It's unkempt.
Yes, exactly.
And you are now here in public, and you look great.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
You look very good, too.
Shaved and washed up.
I did shave.
Your hair looks good.
I washed my hair.
Yeah.
I appreciate your noticing. I did it for you.
You're a good-looking man. You really are.
This is great. I'm going to put that on my website.
Okay.
I appreciate it. It was great to talk to you, and good luck there.
Good seeing you, Sam.
Good seeing you, too.
I'm going to tell all you fascists you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome to the program, live from Netroots Nation, or I should say live from tape from Netroots Nation, is Marcos Melitzis. He is the founder, publisher of Daily Kos, the left's biggest non-corporatized blog that is out there.
And hopefully a longtime friend of Sam.
Well, yes. Marcos was one of the first people I ever interviewed as a radio host, probably even just before I became a real radio host.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. And that was when I was actually a fraction of the influence and size. So I actually have a lot of affection and love for you and everything you've been doing, Sam, because you actually, I think, were part of the reason that Daily Kos has grown.
Well, I appreciate that, Marcos. And we are at Netroots Nation, which originally started as a yearly Kos. And I know this story many times over, but tell the story of how it started, and then let's get into what has changed, not just with the convention, but the blogosphere in general.
Yeah, it started back in 2005, I believe. I had a couple of people from the Daily Kos community, not the Daily Kos staff, because there really wasn't much beyond me, but the Daily Kos community saying that they wanted to get together and meet and meet in person. And I thought, well, great. So the first year, nothing really happened. But then by 2006, they'd gotten their act together, and a lady named Gina Cooper got a group of volunteers. None of them had any experience whatsoever in running conventions or events of any kind. I mean, these were people. Gina Cooper was a school teacher. I mean, these people are nothing to do with convention running. And so Gina comes up to me. She says, "Okay, I think we're ready to pull the trigger. Can we use your name?" And I was like, "Oh man, okay. You guys are who? And you're a teacher. You want to put together a company? Yeah, why the hell not? You know, let's go for it." And by let's, I mean you go for it, because I'm not going to do anything. I'm too busy as it is. And, you know, so it was Yearly Kos was born, and people keep giving credit to Daily Kos and giving credit to me for the conference, when, in fact, all I did was sort of create a sort of platform that allowed these people to come together and organize. So maybe indirectly, Daily Kos is to blame for this conference or get credit. But really, it was a bunch of volunteers who did the work. And what was amazing is that first year in Las Vegas in 2006, I went to the hotel, and it was like the crappiest hotel in Las Vegas.
Yes, I think that hotel, I can't remember which one it was, but I'm fairly convinced that it was destroyed shortly after the convention.
It was a dump. But I walked in, and I expected them to say, okay, the convention in quote marks, is down the hallway, past the water cooler, take a left at the vending machine, and that little room at the back, right?
Right.
That's the convention, right? And I would have been perfectly happy with that, to be honest. And then I walk in, and it's a real convention. And I looked around, and I was like, okay, this is really, really weird. And my name's over everything, the Kos name. And so it's kind of a little surreal. And the best part about that conference for me is at the end of it, a New York Times reporter came up to me, and he said, you know, I've been covering these liberal, progressive conferences for over 20 years. this is the first one I've ever been to where every session started on time. Now, that seems like such a trite thing, right? But to me, it sort of signified kind of a guiding ethos of the Netroots, which is the amateurs will often, if not always, do a better job than the so-called professionals.
Yeah, that first, that's a great point. That first yearly COS was, we had covered it from Air America. The old Majority Report had gone down there to cover it, and there was this sort of, the first day and a half was just everyone just sort of almost astonished that this many people were there, that the crowd was the convention goers were not these pimply-faced 18-year-olds sitting in there, you know, coming out of the basement in their pajamas. They were lawyers and real estate brokers and a huge mix of people and ages that were all adult, and the whole thing worked. That was sort of the stunning.
It busted a lot of stereotypes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I remember the first day there was about 30 reporters there, and suddenly by day three of the conference, there's about 200 reporters there. So I think they all went back and called up their newsrooms and said, holy crap, you got to send more people because this is something's happening here. And something was happening there. And you know, it's funny because I remember my keynote address, right? That was back in the day when we couldn't get better speakers than me, right? So I was a keynote address. And I went up there and I said, you know, I just saw a poll today. And it's that Ned Lamont is beating Joe Lieberman in the Connecticut primary. He's losing by only 15 points, right? Everybody just went crazy. Everybody's political reports are going, wait, Joe Lieberman's winning by 15 points. What are they cheering about? But we'd been down by 40
right.
In the previous poll, and so we had that momentum. And there was this energy of, like, being down by 15 points, that's nothing. We can get through that, right? We can beat that. And, of course, we did beat Joe Lieberman right. In that primary. So it's a time of opportunity. It was a time everything was brand new and exciting. And if you ask what's changed is that we've sort of become more institutionalized as a movement. We're getting more professionalized, but not in a negative way, you know, because we're more sophisticated. People know what they're doing a lot more. The tools have become better. So it's all evolving. And so we're not as fresh and new of a story because we're not fresh and new anymore. But as far as our effectiveness, I think we're still in the upward trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that because I think, you know, there's two elements. When you say the Netroots have become more professionalized, there's almost two sort of elements of that. One is, for instance, Daily Kos or Fire Dog Lake or Crooks and Liars, where these are blogs that have grown bigger. They have staffs now. You provide
18 right now.
I mean, that is a small company.
That's
not even a mid-sized company. But you have a staff and you have. A division that sort of functions on political action and video. And then the other part of the professionalization are where the single bloggers are now parts of institutions and larger media outlets or this and that. And do you think that part of it, where some of those voices have sort of gotten sucked into the institutions of the liberal establishment or the non-establishment?
Yeah, it's happened. I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, if we were complaining that the Washington Post didn't have enough progressive voices, but now we have Greg Sargent, you know, reporting out of the Washington Post, that's a good thing. Or Matt Iglesias and whoever's in, you know, I forget who's where because they switch like every 6 months,
yes,
right? It's like
true.
A revolving
yes.
door. So I lose track of who is where. But you know, the fact is, if the Netroots is sort of a farm team for good progressive voices and they end up in these more traditional media outlets that are looking to ride the wave, I don't see that as a bad thing. I see that as a good thing. I mean, clearly it's not the direction Daily Kos is going to go.
Right.
And if nothing else, my writers have been loyal, and I don't think I've lost a single writer voluntarily. I mean, you know, we've had people die and that sort of thing, but voluntarily somebody leaving and saying, oh, that doesn't happen at Daily Kos, right? Because people are happy with the platform and they're happy with what Daily Kos offers. But if other people elsewhere want to move up to these traditional media outlets, fantastic. I mean, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Because, I mean, what we've seen in the recent past was that it was the right wing that was providing the farm team for a lot of these for a lot of these traditional media outlets. So at least we can start to balance that out.
I think that's a good point. But I think what's so important about a blog like Daily Kos is that While I think there's a lot to be said about having people move up into these institutions and changing the sort of the perspective of the writers in those institutions, the one thing that I that is so crucial about a Daily Blow Kos is that you you don't have to worry about saying certain things that are going to get your organization in trouble. You don't have to worry about saying things that will affect your access.
We have complete and total freedom to be ourselves and to do what made us successful. I mean, we were successful because we were outsiders taking shots at the Beltway insiders, and none of that has changed. It's one of our guiding ethos. You know, we don't care about access. We don't care about being first and having a scoop. Because when you these publications that are so obsessed with the scoop, the way you get the scoop is you pick up favors right from these insider quote insiders. We don't play that insider game. You know, we're on the outside, and if somebody else wants to get the quote scoop, all the power to them because that scoop lasts 5 minutes on the internet.
All right, so let's turn to a minute about what's happening sort of from a political standpoint. I mean, and I want to talk about. One example where for a long time, because we've been talking for years and years about what's been happening with politics, and you were one of the biggest supporters. I want to use this more as an example, but I'd like to hear your thoughts about this. I know that John Tester from Montana, for instance, I cannot think of a single individual who was supportive of John Tester outside of Montana more than you, as early as you. I mean, I think the first time you met him, he was literally stopping his tractor, walking off his tractor on his farm to talk to you, I think for writing when you were writing Crashing the Gates.
Right. I spent time with him researching the book when he was running for Senate. I pushed him heavily into the primary when the establishment had rallied around some no-name lawyer type that, you know, with some money, which is what the DSCC, the Democrats, usually like.
And he was, I think it was a DLCer, and you were very determined.
And John Tester was his farmer, right? You know, it was a state legislator, and wasn't the kind of person that the party gravitates toward. You know, huge champion, raised a ton of money, probably raised more money for him than anybody else I've ever raised money for. Via the community, not me personally,
right,
but via the community. And I remember sitting with Chuck Schumer, and I met with Chuck Schumer in D.C., and, you know, we're talking shop, we're talking races. I mean, the guy's an election junkie extraordinaire, and I kept saying Montana. He's like, no, Montana. I was like, yeah, Montana. This was very early in the cycle, right? And he's like, I'm like, trust me, Montana. And Virginia was the other one with Jim Webb, right?
Right.
But Montana was even bigger. And especially since Virginia's close to D.C., so they're a little more aware of what's happening in Virginia. But Montana's like a whole different world from D.C. And so I pushed him within the party. I pushed him outside the party. I pushed him with the community. And ultimately, he won by, 10,000 votes.
Right.
So we're not talking, you know, I'm not going to say I elected him or anything like that. I don't ever like to overstate my importance, but I'm sure it helped quite a bit to get him over that hump, the money we raised and the attention we got him and the buzz we built. So then he comes in and word is he's going to vote against the DREAM Act. Now the DREAM Act, it legalizes children of undocumented immigrants who either get a college degree or join serve their nation in uniform in the military.
Every single thing that someone would ever say that they would want immigrants to be and why they appreciate immigrants, that was the precondition to getting that citizenship.
And you've already spent tens of thousands of dollars educating them because they have a right to a public education, primary and secondary education, right? So why wouldn't you – this is like such a brain-dead piece of legislation. I cannot believe there's a debate over this. He comes out, you know, and word is he's going to vote against it, right? So I send notice to his staff that this is not a smart decision. You know, the polling shows that it's not, you know, this is not an unpopular piece of legislation by any stretch of the imagination. Americans generally are very supportive of kids making, you know, a good future for themselves,
right,
either serving in the military or going to college. And I got back a bunch of BS about literally the response to that email when me talking about don't take a baseball bat to my brothers and sisters and cousins. I'm Latino. People don't know. The response was, well, you know, he's really supportive of labeling of organic food, you know, from farms. And I was like, well, that's fantastic. I'm happy for organic foods on farms. But what the hell does that have to do with kids who are being deported to countries where they don't even speak the language because they had a temerity to try to get an education? And so when he actually ended up voting for it, you know, my response, and I talked about it here. It's already been reported. My response was just two words, with F you, but not with the F. I mean, the whole word.
Right.
And so never nominate me to be a diplomat or an ambassador.
No, I'm right. No. But I mean, I think the point here is that there was a time where we were talking about where the mantra for the Netroots was more and better Democrats.
Yeah.
And do you think that we have entered an era where we are looking at a different strategy than that? I mean, the idea that maybe the idea isn't necessarily more Democrats, that part of the formula doesn't necessarily pay off in the way that we presume.
Yeah, no, I'm less interested in the more part for a couple of reasons. One, we have a Senate that's broken. Nothing's going to pass the Senate anyway, right? And we saw the House where the Democrats were constantly undermined time and time again by the Blue Dogs. Now, I think as bad as 2010 was, and 2010 was not a good year, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but the silver lining is that the Republicans did us a favor by eliminating the Blue Dogs as a viable and relevant force. I mean, half our losses were Blue Dogs. They were completely decimated. A couple more have announced that they're retiring, right? So their numbers are very, very small. And moving forward, you know, redistricting in California and in Illinois are going to give us opportunities to pick up actual real Democrats. And not to mention that what we've seen with the Paul Ryan budget has completely soured Americans on Republicans in general. The House isn't only in play, but even if we win it by 10 seats, if we have a 10-seat majority, it's going to be a stronger majority than when we had a 80-seat majority with the Blue Dogs making up 60 of those seats, just constantly undermining Pelosi. So the idea is, you know, we don't need these supermajorities anymore. There may be regions that for now are lost. You know, hopefully we can get them back over time. I'm not abandoning anyone. But the idea is, if we're going to have a majority, we need a majority that's actually good Democrats. Otherwise, what's the point? Because, sure, we can try to prevent.
You can get seniority on committees, but it doesn't matter if you can't really pass any legislation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because I guess it's a quality, emphasis on quality as opposed to quantity at this point. And that's a change, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And circumstances have changed, right? And we have to be flexible, obviously, if nothing else. We saw what a Democratic majority that was dominated by corporatist Democrats looked like, and it wasn't pretty. So the idea is, you know, we're going to rebuild this majority. We're going to do it the right way. I mean, we may lose the Senate because the map just looks terrible for us.
Right.
It's not even two people
three
up.
Three to one Democrats running.
And to mention that. All the Republicans that are up for re-election, except for me, Scott Brown and Susan Collins in Maine. Scott Brown's in Massachusetts. Those are the only two real blue right. state Republicans. So we don't have a lot of opportunities. But the Senate's where everything good goes to die anyway, right? So it's not like you need a 60-vote majority to get anything done in the Senate. So they're not going to get Republicans are not going to get 60 votes. We're not going to get 60 votes. It's impossible. So it's going to remain dysfunctional. And so at least let's get the House where, you know, the majority actually can make things happen and pass legislation. And if nothing else, Democrats can use the House as a place where we brand to Americans what Democrats are all about. I mean, Republicans have done that, thankfully, because now they're like, this is what we're about. Right. And Americans are like, oh, wait, no, that's not what we wanted. wait, what? You want to do what? So, Democrats don't have that problem. You know, Democrat problems have been more of nothing happened. They haven't focused so much on the economy. The stimulus was too short, you know, it was too small, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are problems of timidity. And the problems we had, those was because the Blue Dogs kept watering things down. They thought they'd get brownie points from the voters if we take that stimulus that would actually do something and turn it into tax cuts that don't do anything. And the voters didn't care, right? They voted him out anyway.
Well, Marcos Melitzas, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations with all the success of Daily Kos. And at least, you know, you midwifed what we're attending, and it's really impressive. And
appreciate that.
Thanks so much.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made.
for the option where you don't get paid, for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.